Good morning, everyone. If the committee could please come to order, I think I owe Representative Blaine a cup of coffee for arriving and providing us with quorum. It's a little too early in the morning to offer you a cold beer, so at least by my standards. So good morning. Welcome to the 2008 legislative session for the Labor and Consumer Protection Division. Again this year, Mary Faust is the committee legislative assistant. We do have a new committee administrator, Brian Shackleton. Welcome to the committee, Brian. And in addition, although I think out of the room, is Kate in the room? Our page. Timing is everything. I will make sure to introduce Kate Dale, the committee page, when she returns from official duties. Our first bill up this morning is House File 439. Representative Greiling. Representative Lane moves that House File 439 be recommended to pass and we refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Thank you, Representative Lane. Good morning, Representative Greiling. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you very much. And after this hearing, we'll take the beer if you have
it. Not in the office, just to clarify for the record.
All right. Yeah. And thank you. Thank you for moving the bill. House File 439 is a straightforward bill that just requires sellers of real estate to disclose to the buyers whether or not they have a past survey of their property. They don't have to get one if they don't already have one, but if they do have one, they have to disclose it and give a copy to the buyer. And this would apply to sellers if they have a realtor or if they don't. And that's basically what it does. It was brought to me by my constituent who's with me today, Don Snow from Roseville, and he has run across this problem that he says is common. So I think, Mr. Chair, I'd like to have the committee hear from him of his story briefly, and then I know that the realtors are here and they've talked with me kindly to let me know they oppose the bill. And then the land surveyors who could not be here today support the bill. Nancy Haas is their lobbyist, and they actually have their 2008 legislative initiative, and this is their second proposal of those that they're actively supporting. They support the property seller being required to disclose and provide to buyers known existing land surveys. The Minnesota Society of Professional Surveyors supports an initiative to require property sellers and their real estate agents to disclose and provide to buyers any known existing land surveys. So they couldn't be here today, but they wanted me to share that with you.
Well, Representative Garland, why don't we ask Ms. Dale, when she's done with this, to make copies of that and distribute it to committee members so that everyone has.
Oh, that'd be great.
Some of us are visual learners,
Alrighty.
If you know.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Snow, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape. Proceed and do be aware that, particularly with others to testify, brevity is extra credit around here.
My name is Don Snow. I live in Roseville, Minnesota. My family owns property in Aiken County, Wagner Township, on South Big Pine Lake. And the problem I've had, and many others on the lake we have property on have had it also, is that people are selling and buying property without really finding out from the seller before they're buying where their property lines are. And it's forcing the neighbors to have their property lines surveyed to put an end to arguments, bickering. And my situation is simply this. I have two neighbors. We've had the property since it was subdivided from farm pasture. The neighbors on either side of it, their land has changed hands at least three times. And each time it's changed hands, the sellers have not told the buyers where their property lines are. A plat just shows you lines on a piece of paper. It does not actually show you in real life where your property lines are. Ergo, I've had nothing but trouble. And in the equation of the seller and the buyer and the realtor, everybody leaves out the neighbors. And they're the ones that are left to clean up the mess that's produced by a seller, a buyer, and a realtor that don't point out to the potential buyer where his landlines are. I am not the only one on this lake that's had the problem. I've been going up there for 55 years, since I was 2.5 years old. I know a lot of people up there, and I'm related to half of Kennebec County. Everybody I talk to has had the same problem. And part of the problem, too, is some of the original surveys were not done very accurately. Back when the land was purchased 55 years ago, land prices were pretty minimal. And the care that was taken in the original survey sometimes wasn't that good, depending on the surveyor himself or who did it originally. But my final point is simply this. It may be legal to sell property without, you know, resurveying or at least locating where the property lines are to the best of your ability or admitting that you don't know where they are. But I don't think it's very ethical. You're putting the neighbors and the adjoining property owners in a very untenable situation. They have to literally end up in a fight with people they barely know. And it's just not right, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Thank you, Mr. Snow. Any questions for the testifier? Hearing none, then Christine Berger from the Minnesota Association of Realtors. If you'd please come down. Good morning, Ms. Berger. Welcome to 2008.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the division. My name is Christine Berger, and I represent, along with my colleague, Susan Diori, the Minnesota Association of Realtors, 25,000 members strong. The Minnesota Association of Realtors respectfully opposes House File 439. The bill seeks to modify current law disclosure of a real estate transaction. The Minnesota Association of Realtors has long supported disclosure of material facts to the best of the seller's and licensee's knowledge, not to mention the many other specific disclosure requirements under the real estate licensing law, such as agency, conflicts of interest, and conflicts of financial interest in the real property being transferred. Under current law, licensees and sellers must disclose to prospective purchasers all material facts of which licensee and the seller are aware that could adversely or significantly affect the purchaser's use or enjoyment of the property. We oppose this bill because, one, the new disclosure would be precedent-setting. If this were adopted, where would one draw the line on the list of new material fact disclosure requirements that would be required? It opens a Pandora's box. Two, if a new list of disclosure requirements were created, as this bill would do, would items or issues not on that list no longer be considered material fact? Three, the proposed language in House File 439 on the disclosure of the existence of a plat of a survey would not be necessary because if the existence of a plat of a survey is material fact, it is covered under the current law. In addition, real estate transaction forms would have to, they are not created based on whether a property adjoins a lake or not, and therefore the bill would force residential real estate disclosure forms to be modified and could end up forcing this type of very specific disclosure in the future for all properties, no matter where they are located. Furthermore, the bill adds additional liability to sellers, particularly lake sellers, lake homeowners sellers. If a seller fails to disclose they knew of a plat of an existence, a plat of a survey's existence, then they are liable to the buyer, and the buyer can bring a civil action. Finally, this bill opens up the question, if a seller fails to disclose information about the existence of a plat of a survey, does the seller also fail on the primary material fact disclosure in current law? The Minnesota Association of Realtors respectfully asks you to oppose this bill. The modifications would bring disclosure out of line with existing disclosure requirements. I'll conclude my comments with that since you want people to be brief. Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you. Any questions from the committee? Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Berger. I mean, you went over your objections, but this does seem to be an issue here if people don't know the property line. So what would your alternative be to address clearly what does appear to be a problem?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Ms. Berger.
Thank you. If there is, if the buyer has a question when purchasing a property, they can receive a survey, which will actually get you the actual lines drawn on your property. If they're, you know, thinking about purchasing the property, they can go ahead and have a survey conducted that would outline where the property lines are.
I have a point about that.
Mr. Snow?
The problem with that is in the situation I face, both the neighbors on either side of me did not know where their property lines were after they bought their property, which put me in the position where I had to hire a surveyor and pay him $650 to find out exactly what I already knew. And, I mean, I was literally accused of moving stakes by people, and I said, well, what do you mean? How do you know I did it? So I literally became angry and hired a surveyor and had to pay money to find out literally what I already knew. And another thing about lakeshore property that people forget, because you are following an irregular shoreline, surveyors shoot in a straight line. In other words, they'll shoot so many lots, but then they have to change direction because of the contour change in the lake. And the road that access road that goes around the lake usually doesn't exactly follow the contour of the lakeshore. So consequently, the lots are quadrangles, which means no two lines are parallel to each other on a four-sided figure. So consequently, the lots are very irregularly shaped in many cases, and it leads to a lot of confusion. You can't just look at it and say, well, I've got so many feet by so many feet. It doesn't work that way, because a quadrangle can be very misleading, and that's a unique situation to lakeshore property. The only other place you really run into it are on cul-de-sacs where people have pie-shaped lots. Mm-hmm. And there again, there's been a lot, I've heard of a lot of people having troubles on cul-de-sacs for this very same reason, because of the oddness of the shape of the lot.
All right, thank you. Representative Hoyson, follow up?
No, thank you.
Representative Peterson.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Meyer, if a licensed realtor part of your association would use probably a purchase agreement that was drafted under common language on the association, and that clearly states that, talks about surveys and lot lines, if I'm not mistaken. And I'm going to lead you a little further. Most any realtor would make sure that there was confirmation of boundary lines and or an existing survey. And lead you a little further, any bank that you go to finance this thing would absolutely require either title insurance, which would require a survey. Now, you can't protect against stupid. And you start writing, people start buying real estate without surveys, on word of mouth, without financing. I don't know how you legislate that. I'm leading it, I'm sorry. But take me back to the question of the purchase agreement and the text in there that deals with surveyor boundary lines.
Ms. Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our realtors are required to disclose to the best of their knowledge. So if something is indicated on the forms in the purchase agreement, then that has been disclosed.
And
in that agreement, the seller and the buyer both make warranties and representations. And so the seller is representing to the buyer that the boundary lines as provided in this document are accurate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Peterson. If the seller and the licensee are indeed putting those statements on the documents, then that has to be an honest representation. If it's incorrect, there are procedures in current law that the buyer, he or she feels she's been wrong, or she's been wrong, there are procedures in law that they can, currently in law, that they can do.
Representative Peterson?
Mr. Chairman, the law books are full of disputes from years and years and years about boundary questions and lakeshore developments. The famous one was, I think it was Jim Craig and this thing up on Bay Lake where they did huge developments and all the lot lines. So I just don't have empathy that we start writing laws that make this requirement. I just think we're walking into very thin ice on issues that I don't think we need to get into. The courts are just full of these cases, and I would suggest that Mr. Snow, you did the exact right thing. If there's a dispute, you get it surveyed, and the courts will protect you for a very long time. And if your neighbor bought that thing and did it just on an assumption and a whim, that's really their problem and not yours. And you've now got a survey, so at some point in time you want to transfer this property to your estate or your children or to sell it, you're standing on good ground. But to require everybody else to have it or to transfer property without it, and people go into those kind of purchase agreements and do that without checking it, it just defies my logic why they would throw their money away then.
You're missing the point. Why should the neighbor, who has nothing to do with the purchase of that property, have to survey his property to prove to the buyer where the line was when the buyer should have found that out before he purchased it?
But if I'm sitting there as an owner for many years and I don't know what I own, you're suggesting that neighbor who's been on that property for X years and doesn't have a clue where his own boundaries are? I mean, I don't...
In my case, they never did.
I think we've discovered the rationale for the bill.
Yeah.
Any other questions for any of the testifiers, any committee members? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a comment first and then a couple of questions. The comment was made about surveyors, that they surveyed a certain way and then changed the line and go a different direction. Just to protect the surveyors of the world, who are very good people, they draw perfectly straight lines. Unless someone sells something and wants to make it a very difficult situation and a very difficult lay of land, so then they have to change the lines to accommodate the sellers and buyers and make sure that everybody gets a little piece of the lake property or farm country. My question would be for either the author of the bill or Ms. Berger. The way I read this, correct me if I'm wrong, I do have a real estate license, but that law is so confusing. It's even more confusing than anything we do here in the legislature. If this were to pass, and I sell my house, which I have deeded access to the lake, and there isn't a survey, do I have to get one? Because I read it that if I know of one, I have to provide it. But if there isn't one, do I, as the seller, have to get that?
Ms. Berger, do you want to take that, or Representative Greiling, do you want to take that? It was addressed either.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative House. You wouldn't have to get one. We're trying to have a modest proposal so that at least there's truth in advertising for what there is. And so that if there is a land survey, then that does have to be shared. But we decided not to require one if there isn't one, because we're looking for some moderate proposal that could actually progress.
Representative House.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greiling, with all due respect to the Minnesota Realtors Association, this is simply something like if you have rodents, you must say so on the purchase agreement. If you have a leaky basement, a wet basement that floods every other year, you have to say that. But I don't see a problem here. This is just something. If you have a plot plan, you have to present it. If you don't, you don't have to talk about it at all. So I think this bill is pretty soft. I think it's going to be okay. I would give it my support.
I praise. One further point, though, and
no.
People don't realize this, too. Property that's been around for any period of time, many times the stakes have been destroyed or removed, and somebody walks up and says, well, here's the plat, and here's where I think the line is, and the guy says, where is the stake? The guy says, they haven't been here in years. Who took them out? I don't know. Maybe my grandkids did, when they were pushing the lawnmower or something. Everybody's always got a ton of excuses about that. I mean, of the neighbors on either side of me, the only ones that had the original stake still in the ground was me. Everybody else, their stakes were gone. Now, wasn't that very convenient for them? It makes me wonder.
Representative Garland, We got moving a little too quickly this morning, and I apologize to you and the committee members. I do have the 439A1 amendment, which my understanding is your amendment and is technical in nature.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I apologize for not remembering that as well. Mr. Kender updated the bill because we introduced it last year. Some other laws passed, and so we just need this updated version. So I would appreciate that being moved.
Then the chair moves the 439A1 amendment to get the bill in the order the author requests. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. With that, Representative Greiling, any closing comments on House Bill 439?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the member's time. I appreciate the thoughtful process. You can see there's a problem with the discussion here. Rest of House included it's not doing too much damage, and I'm hoping it would do some good with these kinds of arguments that shouldn't have to take place with people that should be neighbors having their beer at the lake together.
All right. Thank you, Representative Greiling. My apologies, Representative Anderson. I didn't see your hand up earlier.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment to Mr. Snow. Out of full disclosure, I hope you understand that this bill won't necessarily address your concerns. Your two neighbors on the either side don't have or don't are not aware of having a flat survey when the realtor sells it to somebody else.
I'm sorry. I can't hear you. I couldn't understand.
Okay, let me just start over, Mr. Snow. I just want to, out of full disclosure, make you aware that if your neighbors down the road choose to sell their property and they're not aware of any flat survey or things of that nature or something to this extent, this will not address your problem or your neighbor's problems around the lake. And so, just so you know, it's not going to necessarily help you because if they're not aware of having this plat survey, you're out of luck, and you're going to have to go through the whole process all over again and pay, you know.
I understand that. That's why I had a survey.
Mr. Snow, Representative Anderson.
So I think out of, just for your own understanding, this is not necessarily a quick fix to the problem that you're discussing, and I agree with Representative Peterson. You know, if people are buying property and not knowing where the boundaries are, it's pretty foolish of them to do that. And, you know, you can, I guess I wouldn't be putting money down for a property I'm not sure exists. So I just make you aware of that. I want you to be fully aware of that problem, okay?
All right. Thank you very much. With that, Representative Lane renews her motion that House File 439, as amended, be recommended to pass and then referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Next on our agenda, Representative Nelson, House File 1596. And I believe there is an amendment on this.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to get the order right this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. As a member of the committee, would you like to move House File 1596 to be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor?
I would like to move that, sir.
Thank you. And then do you wish to move the H1596A1 amendment?
I'd also like to move the H1596A1 amendment. It's a very technical amendment. It's just the section of law that the bill was drafted to has been used last year by another law that was passed. And so we're just changing the section of law from 16C251 to 16C252. That's the only effect of the amendment.
All right. Members, all those in favor of the motion on the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Nelson, the bill is in the order that you prefer. Please proceed.
Anyway, this bill, if it's passed, 1596, would allow State Department the ability to use project labor agreements. And again, this is not a mandate, it's just allowing them. If you read the bill, it says they may use this agreement, a labor agreement. Project labor agreements are contracts between owners, in this case the state of Minnesota, and labor unions. And it is to promote labor harmony and the timely completion of the work. Sometimes on time-sensitive construction projects, where getting the job done is critical and getting it done on time, this is a tool that can be used to help ensure the labor problems are not a cause for delay on the project. In return for assurances that the workers will be union workers, the unions give up the right to strike. The unions agree that any issues that lead to strikes, that could lead to strikes or walkouts, picketing or jurisdictional disputes, will be handled by and between the unions and not lead to slowdowns on the project. Again, this is not a mandate. Some people will say this mandate that, but this is not a mandate, but it's just a tool that the state can use from time to time on critical projects. There are some that will say that this will exclude some contractors who are not unions from bidding on these projects. This is not true. No contractor is required to sign a union agreement, and if they meet the other requirements that the state has, project labor or not, prevailing wage and the like of the current law, they can still bid on the job and perform the work. In closing, this is a tool to give managers of state departments to ensure the time of completion of time-sensitive work, and not a mandate for that this be used on any or all projects for the state of Minnesota. Thank you, and I stand for questions, and I think there's a couple testifiers here that would want to testify for and against the bill.
All right. Representative Peterson.
Quick question. So the state can't do that now?
Representative Nelson.
At the current time, there's an executive order that was signed. We used to be able to do this, the state used to. There's an executive order that's been signed prohibiting this.
Representative Peterson.
Yes. That is this document that was just passed out?
Yes, it is.
I don't have that slide.
Ms. Dale, could you please get Representative Nelson a copy of the governor's order, please?
Thank you.
Representative Peterson?
I haven't had a chance to read this executive order, but does this require the state not do this? I mean, what does this say?
Representative Nelson.
I believe what this states is that it basically prohibits the state from doing it by the governor's executive order.
Representative Peterson?
I have to read this. I don't...
I wasn't sure what the problem is.
I'm trying to figure out what the problem is here.
Mr. Chair, if this happened, this would overturn the governor's executive order.
Representative Peterson?
It's like an override, huh? Oh, man.
I'll let you decide. Representative Anderson.
Oh, Representative Nelson, I just looked through this very quickly, so I guess when I'm looking through the executive order, as I see it, that the executive order just says that you cannot discriminate on who you award your contracts to and doesn't say that you couldn't hire somebody that had a project labor agreement. Can you point out to me where it says that you cannot hire somebody that has a project labor agreement?
Representative Nelson.
Read the executive order I'm not sure where it says that in there. Like I said, with the executive order, my understanding of it, I don't know all the words that are in here, but it's basically... Before, there were state departments for using that. If the department signed those agreements, the governor, with this executive order, prohibited the state from signing the project labor agreement. It's not the contractor, it's the owner of the project that signs the project labor agreement. And so in this case, the state. And this, my understanding is that this governor's executive order prohibits that.
Representative
Law, there was a policy, it wasn't a law before. This would make it a law.
Representative Anderson, if you look at the top of the second page, 2A, I think that's the language that you're asking about.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions for the author? Representative Howes.
Mr. Chairman, I see we have some people in the audience who will probably testify on behalf of the bill, and I would like them to explain to us what this means to this, because I don't understand this, and not understanding this, I don't understand why this. It would help us, I think.
Okay. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify in favor of House File 1596? Good morning, Mr. Anpeng. If you'd please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dick Anpeng. I have the privilege of being the president of the Minnesota State Building and Construction Trades Council, have been for a number of years, and have been involved with project labor agreements my entire career, which it's hard to tell, but it's almost 40 years.
Can't be true.
First of all, is it okay if I address the question at hand? I think the question that was just arisen was, couldn't the state do this before? And before the executive order, the state could do it. And the reason that the state needed to do it, to make it a state agreement between the state and a labor organization, is that's what federal law, that's what the Supreme Court said must happen. It must be the public entity that asks for, agrees to, and negotiates a project labor agreement, which then becomes part of the bid documents for all contractors bidding the project to understand and include in their consideration when they bid. The executive order eliminated the ability of the state to enter into that contract. It did not eliminate the possibility of having a project labor agreement on the project. Only in that case, the state cannot receive the benefits of a project labor agreement in exactly the same way as if they signed it or the general contractor, because it happens then after the bid process. So considerations, so the law, the Supreme Court said, when you're acting in a proprietary manner, any public entity, you have the right to act as though you were a private entity and enter into such agreements that exist in the private sector. And project labor agreements are widely used in the private sector. And but we have to differentiate, because there are different rules under a public sector project labor agreement versus a private sector project agreement. A private sector project agreement can absolutely require every contractor to be a signatory contractor, and every craft person entering the site must carry a union card. On a public sector, that is not the case.
Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I think I understand now what it is, and I'll give you an example. You tell me if I'm right or wrong. State of Minnesota could award a contract to Mortenson, let's say, or any contractor like them. And they could call Mortenson up on the phone or another contractor and say, we want to make sure that the carpenters you hire here won't walk out or go on strike at some time during this project. Can you guarantee that to us? And the way it is now, obviously Mortenson would not be able to guarantee that unless they had an agreement with the carpenters union. But before this proclamation, the state of Minnesota could pick up the phone and call the carpenters union and say, when this project comes forward, can we have an understanding with you that there will not be a strike or walkout or anything during the duration of this project? Is that how it works?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, Representative House, that is very close. However, project labor agreements are not signed with a single labor organization. They're signed with a building trades council on behalf of all affiliates and all crafts that are affiliated with that council. So the state could, in their preparations for construction of a project or remodeling or whatever it is, either determine, yes, there's value or it's appropriate to have a PLA on this project or not. If they decide that it is appropriate and it meets the criteria of the Supreme Court decision, then they can call on behalf of the state, the local building trades council, and say, well, let's talk about this. And through the talks, a PLA can be negotiated whereby those concerns are addressed. And typically the end result is that the various work rules are described for all contractors, holidays, to uniformly present to all the contractors and workers what certain things are going to happen that might not happen under local agreements, individual agreements, and there's a no-strike, no-lockout clause which prohibits any union to interrupt the progress of that project as it moves forward.
Any other questions for Mr. Anfang? Representative Peterson.
I'm not sure what question I'm asking, but so this language would suggest that when this proclamation was signed in November of 2005, that the state has not entered into any contracts with where they had people with labor agreements? I mean, what's happened? This was done November of 2005, so 2006, 2007, for 2.5 years, this document has kept something from happening that this new law requires to reverse. I just want to make sure this isn't just an opportunity to throw this in the face of the administration. I don't think that's where you're going with it, so I'm trying to understand why we're doing it.
Mr. Ramsey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, I wouldn't use the term throw in the face. A little bit of history on executive orders on PLAs. Shortly after President Bush took office, he issued an executive order on behalf of the federal government prohibiting the federal government to seek out a project labor agreement with a building trades organization or any labor organization. Prohibited them from asking for it. Shortly after Governor Valenti took office, he issued virtually an identical order which prohibited the Department of Administration or any letting agency of the state to call the building trades or call any labor organization to enter into any kind of an agreement that controls labor or whatever. So the governor's order says the state can't do it. Now, there has not been a call from any state agency asking any building trades council in the state of Minnesota that I'm aware of to enter into an agreement. But after the fact, after the bids are let, this executive order does not prohibit a contractor then who has been awarded the work to then come to on their own behalf and enter into that project labor agreement, which has happened several times and sometimes not. But it does take away the ability of the state to negotiate the type of concerns they might have with the labor union. And this, I could elaborate if you'd like on what I think the downside is, but of the state not being able to do it.
Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson.
And also, you said require. Does it require them? It just allows, it's another tool for the state if they deem that they need to have this on a certain project. It's another tool that they can use. And it's not requiring anyone to do it. It's just they can use it, but the bill says they may use it.
And so follow-up. Your bill is not an affront to this executive order. I'm asking it that way because at this early part of our session, you don't need to piss anybody off. Excuse me. And I'm just trying to...
It could be deemed as an affront. I mean, if you take it that way, it's not. I don't believe it's an affront, but it could be taken that way. Yes.
Representative Lane.
I think I would like you to see if I have this understanding. In the governor's order, it says that basically contracts cannot require adhering to agreements with a labor union. And what this says is that they may enter into an agreement that would require adhering to an agreement with the labor union. So that you could have an agreement with the labor union. A state department could do a contract and have an agreement in that process with the labor union to adhere to something. And what we have in the governor's order is that it's basically null and void. You can't require them to adhere to an agreement. It says not require adhering to agreements with one or more labor unions. And this simply says you may enter into an agreement that would have that requirement in it. You don't have to, but you may.
Mm-hmm.
So it clarifies it in that sense and says that it can't be eliminated.
I believe it says the chairman, representative, the interpretation is that the state agencies cannot. However, the low bid contractors can. And there's nothing that's just That's what it says. That the state will not, by executive order, solicit or enter into a project labor agreement with a labor union. However, the successful low bidder, or even during the process, although all bidders might want to come to a, and it has happened where all low bidders have come and said, we'd like to be assured that if we get the bid, it's covered under a PLA. But they don't know that until they have the low bidder and until a PLA is successfully negotiated. And therefore, when they're going through the bidding process, they don't know that at the end of the day, whether they'll have those protections that are included in a project agreement on the project. So they have to put into their bid contingencies for that in case there, for some reason, a successful negotiation for project agreement cannot be reached.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Anfang, it says in this executive order that one of the reasons he came forth with it was to promote and ensure open competition. Mm-hmm. If there is a project labor agreement, and there is, do we ever have non-union companies or contractors work in that project labor agreement, knowing the prevailing wage stands for everyone? That's not an issue. So the amount that a contractor will bid a contract on, they basically can be both.
To
work together with private contractors, basically.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there's a long history of non-union or contractors that are not signatory to a labor agreement participating in public sector project labor agreements that dates back to before the Supreme Court. So yes, they do. There's nothing that prohibits them from doing so, other than, and you will hear testimony this morning, I'm sure, other than what they perceive to be discriminating things and rules that they can't abide by and things like that. I'll let them do that. But the law clearly describes that you cannot discriminate against anyone based upon their affiliation with or not affiliation with the labor union. Therefore, you must allow them to bid. The only thing the project labor agreement says, if it is adopted by the public, between the public entity and the labor agreement, labor, is that it becomes part of the specifications of the project that Labor Day will be a holiday, Christmas will be a holiday, drug testing will occur. Those kinds of things are often and most always included in a project labor agreement in order to provide uniformity for all of the contractors so that as they manage the project, they know what the rules are for everyone. And the prevailing rate does pretty much set the wages, but the non-union or non-signatory contractor must agree to abide by that. And we believe because there's another state law that requires them to pay a prevailing rate of wages, that wages should not be the issue. So,
thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else in the audience wishes to testify in favor of House File 1596? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative. Actually, Representative Howes was on the list first, and then we'll come to you, so that's all right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't want to be redundant, and I'll try not to be, even though I've been told I have been on occasion, but I want to make this very clear, just for the comfort of some people. This really doesn't have anything to do with wage demands by union contractors. Doesn't have anything to do with wages at all. This simply means that you have an agreement that you're not going to have difficulties during this job. Nobody's going to walk out. You're all going to honor the holidays. And with respect to whether or not someone wants to determine that this is a small veto of something the governor has done, I do not think that the governor would take it that way and he would be offended. He is a hockey player. He's had his bumps and bruises. And I don't think that this is going to bother him or he's going to lose any sleep over it at all.
Thank you. Representative Dietrich.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, for one, would like to know what is the downside to the state?
Mr. Anfang?
The downside of the executive order or the downside of the bill?
The downside Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The downside of not being able to negotiate project labor agreements in the front end from an agency, etc.
Mr. Ehrenstein.
Thank you very much for the question, Representative. It's a good question. The downside to the state does not have the ability to enter into, in my opinion, is they're not allowed to interject their desires of how the job should go at an early stage of design, of bidding. They're not allowed to inform all the bidders what the criteria that they desire might be, might want, certain things that the state might need that could be negotiated with the labor organization to put into a project labor agreement at the end of the day. And that is the first downside, I think. And the second downside is if those negotiations don't occur, then all bidders, whether they be signatory or not, have to face the possibility that this group of workers or contractors might not want to adhere to the same policies or might not want to adhere to drug testing or whatever else might not be in state law that could be negotiated in a PLA. The state can't say that, and the contractors are therefore uncertain. So when they bid that, in order to, they have their caught between a hard spot, whether they got to be the low bidder, but yet they have to build in fiscal, financial, they have to estimate what the cost would be should that bump in the road occur. And with a PLA, it's not going to occur, so they have to adjust their costs accordingly if to make sure that they're covered. Financially, so that they can complete the job. Those are the two major things I can think of right now.
So without a PLA, you have to adjust in your financial projections, bids, acceptance of bids, that somebody might go on strike?
If I were a contractor, that I would consider that as a reality. It is a reality in the construction industry.
So, Mr. Chairman, so when we're building schools out there, if we don't have the ability to negotiate a PLA, we have to presume in our bids and what we go out and ask the taxpayers for is that there could be some sort of strike and delay in the project.
Mr. Ehrenstein.
That's true in the way I interpret the world. However, this bill only applies to state-led projects, not schools, not St. Paul, not Minneapolis, just to the state of Minnesota for taxpayer dollars.
Mr. Also on the list to testify is Mr. Bob, is it Heise, my apologies. You wanted to come down at this time? Seeing no other questions for Mr. Ehrenstein. Mr. Heise, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bob Heise. I'm the president of Associated Builders and Contractors. We have approximately 400 members that employ 25,000 people around the state. We are opposed to the resolution that would dismantle the governor's executive order. Why would you do it? He signed it in 2005, and all it really does is provide for open and fair competition on state construction projects. It simply ensures there is equal access to state work by all contractors, regardless of their union affiliation. It especially hurts the workers to see you take this action when 3 out of 4 workers today in Minnesota, 77%, choose not to work for Mayor Chop's companies. They're dedicated to these companies. They do their work on time, on budget. They care about quality and they care about safety. We have a partnership with MnOSHA. That's all about safety. What in essence you would do is eliminate competition and drive the cost up of construction work by giving one special interest group exclusivity on the work. No, this is more than a holiday. This is not Christmas for Mayor Chop contractors, it's a lump of coal. The devil is in the details. I don't think you heard the details this morning. We could spend a long time talking about them, but simply, you forced to hire your workers from the union hall. You are forced to pay double benefits, not only your own benefits, but benefits into the union's pool. PLAs, if imposed by a state agency, discriminate against the majority of taxpayers. Is this what's best for Minnesota? I think that's what you have to ask yourself today. It might be best for one special interest group, but is it best for Minnesotans? Why discriminate against contractors, citizens, voters, just because they choose not to be signatory union contractors? I talked to a contractor yesterday. He pays $2 over the prevailing wage and has a very rich benefit program. He's a member of my organization. He's down in Rushford, Minnesota today, helping flood victims. He's refurbishing a house. He's been going down there about every other Friday. These aren't bad people. Some of them might live in your own district. Some of them might have voted for you. Why do you want to discriminate against them and exclusively pick one contractor over another? This simply drives up the cost. There is no valid economic justification for a PLA on state work. One more point, Mr. Chairman, before I close. I appreciate your time this morning. Speaking of the courts, you've heard some talk about the courts. You know, there's private PLAs, public PLAs. We're talking about PLAs that impact executive orders here today. And I think it's important for this discussion we stay on task. The last court decision on executive orders and PLAs, to stay on point, was in 2002. The U.S. Court of Appeals from the District of Columbia said that the federal executive order prohibiting PLAs on federally funded projects works because the government unquestionably is the proprietor of its own funds, and when it acts to ensure the most effective use of these funds, it is acting in a proprietary capacity. In closing, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, nothing in this executive order prohibits any contractor from voluntarily signing a project labor agreement. When Flatiron got the contract to build the I-35W bridge, if you like it or not, they got the contract. They signed a project labor agreement with the Minneapolis Building Trades Council. The unions got their PLA, but MnDOT did not require Flatiron to sign a PLA. Why would they? Flatiron said, heck, we'll talk to Minneapolis, we'll talk to their trade councils, and they signed it, and all the union staff are working on it today. So, you know, I just don't see the big deal with this. I make copies of this because I would take exception with Representative House. I think the governor would be, to quote Representative Peterson, would be pissed off. I'll tell you what. It took us 18 months, Representative. 18 months to get this thing signed. 18 months. And you know what? When the governor sat down and did it, he believed in what he did passionately. He wouldn't have done it for any other reason. I ask you today, is it worth it to dismantle, to start dismantling executive orders signed by our governor? Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Heitz. Any questions for the testifier?
Chairman?
Mr. Ramsey.
Could I have one more?
One last brief comment, sir.
I would simply like to reinforce the fact that public project labor agreements do not discriminate against any contractor on any basis. Any contractor that feels he or she has the ability to perform the work with their workforce is able to bid that work, and in many, many, many cases, that is the case. The Boston Harbor cleanup project was built with over 35% non-union, non-signatory contractors, and it was done Well, that's a massive project, and it took a long time to do, but it had many, many non-signatories on it. The double benefit allegation was for a long time a problem, and the Associated Builders and Contractors had a valid point. And for years, we didn't, we felt we had to find a solution to that problem. And so about 4 years ago, we did. And we developed a health reimbursement account within the public sector PLA that when a non-signatory contractor can show that they have bona fide fringe benefits and they can show the cost of those benefits, and if there is a difference between those benefit costs and the prevailing rate or the union, they can put those dollars into the health reimbursement account to the benefit of the worker, not the contractor. That goes in there, and when the worker has money contributed and they're in there, and then after the fact they can remove those funds for the purposes of health care costs. So there is, and if there's a pension involved, they don't have to contribute to an existing pension. They can put it on their check or put it in there or continue to put it in whatever pension fund they had, as long as it's recorded and that level of the prevailing rate has been met through bona fide benefit plan. There's no discrimination and there's no double payment of rates.
Any other questions for any of the testifiers? Seeing none, Representative Nelson, do you wish to make any closing comments?
Just in closing comment again, if this is not a mandate, it's just another tool that we can give the state to try and get jobs done in a timely fashion. Like Representative Dietrich said, this is a way that they can ensure, the state of Minnesota can ensure on their projects, like on a school where they are time sensitive, but they have to get that school open for the fall school year, that say if they have a project they need to get done in a timely fashion, they can use this as another tool to do it. And that's what the bill's about. And I appreciate your support.
With that, Representative Nelson renews his motion that House File 1596, as amended, be recommended to pass and we refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Wait,
oh, I'm
on. I thought we would have a chance to comment afterwards.
I'm sorry, I didn't see any other comments or questions. I'll withdraw the motion, Representative Anderson.
I apologize, Mr. Chair. I'm still struggling over the language here on the executive order, and now with the testimony of Mr. Heiss saying that the MnDOT 35W bridge has a PLA. I was just hoping that maybe staff can just give further clarification, because when I'm reading it, I'm starting on page 1, number 2, and it starts as a, you know, blah, 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 and it says, does not, and you turn to the second page, says, does not require or prohibit bidders, contractors, subcontractors, or vendors to or from entering into or adhering to agreements with one or more labor organizations. I guess I'm confused. To me, that says that either or. It's just not requiring or prohibiting PLAs from happening. And now, since the 35W bridge has a PLA, can you tell me definitively, is this a prohibition on PLAs or not?
Ms. Newman, can you clarify for us, please?
And Representative Anderson, the executive order prohibits the state from either requiring or prohibiting a project labor agreement in its bid process with the bidders and the contractors. It doesn't prohibit the contractors from entering into a project labor agreement. It's a step higher.
Okay.
It's the agreement between the state and potential bidders.
Okay. Ms. Newman, so to put it in words that I understand, the state cannot require as a condition of awarding the contract that the contractor enter into a PLA, but the contractor of their own free will after the signing of the contract may enter into a PLA.
Mm-hmm. And so then Mr. Chair, then what this bill is saying is that the state may require, and so then we're practicing discriminatory practices then, or what?
Well, defer that to Representative Nelson as opposed to counsel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson. Actually, if you look at it, if the state has the ability to require project labor agreement, they cannot require that they be all union. In the case of Flatiron, they signed a private sector, which there are two different types of project labor agreements, and that was referenced a little bit earlier. On a private sector, the private sector project labor agreement, the owner can require that everyone that work on the project be union. Where on a public sector, it's the opposite, where whoever's the low bidder, you can get a non-union contractor on there. In a lot of cases, there's been that, where if there's a project labor agreement and union and non-union contractors have been on the project and got pieces of it, the state can't require them to be union. A public entity cannot require a all-union project, but they can require that the workers get the protections of the union and get the agreement. So, I mean, actually Flatiron, what this project labor agreement that Flatiron signed is more restrictive than what the state has here. And the non-union aren't able to bid on that because they signed a private sector project labor agreement, and therefore only union contractors can bid on that work. So the non-union or non-signatory contractors can't work on that project.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Comments, questions? Seeing none, we'll try this again. Representative Nelson renews his motion that House File 1596 is amended, be recommended to pass, and sent to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 All those opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Lesch has House File 1158. Representative Lesch.
That's my nickname with all this.
I apologize, sir. We are scheduled to adjourn at 11:30. I would like to hold to that, which probably limits both proponents and opponents to about 7 minutes each of testimony. Is that acceptable?
I think our case is so strong that we'll take even less than that and give more time to the opposition.
You know, it's a deal. Representative Nelson, would you be good enough to move House File 1158, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor?
So moved.
And do you have an amendment on this? Thank you very much, Ms. Faust. The Chair will move the H-1158-A1 amendment to be before the Committee. Representative Lesch is this year. Amendment.
Yes, it is my amendment, Mr. Chair, although I'm going to take the unfrozen caveman lawyer approach and ask Ms. Newman to explain it because it's technical and I don't get it.
All right.
It's necessary and technical. If Ms. Newman would.
Ms. Newman, please.
Mr. Chair and a member of the committee, the amendment does two things. It updates the statutory references to the laws that were passed last year, rather than the 2006 version. And Section 1 actually makes a corresponding change in another section of law where the waiting week is. There's a reference to it, and the original bill did not have that.
All right. With that, members, the chair moves the H-1158-A1 amendment. Oh, my apologies. Do other members not have the amendment either? Just Representative Peterson got it? He was the lucky winner? We're all good. Check under your chair for 20s later. Running a lottery.
Nope.
With that, this is merely an amendment that brings the bill in the order of the author prefers. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Representative Lesch, your bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, this is a pretty straightforward bill. Currently, if you become unemployed and you apply for unemployment benefits, you have to wait a week before you don't get paid for a week. And I looked at that, and I was trying to figure out why a couple of years ago upon request by a constituent, and I was looking in to determine why this was, and I couldn't figure out a good reason other than, well, it costs less money for the employer. No big surprise. Unemployment insurance costs money. That's why you pay for it. But I don't think there's a really good reason to wait a week. Your mortgage doesn't wait a week. You don't get a quarter off your mortgage, and you don't your family doesn't end up fasting for a week. You still have to pay for things. So I thought it made sense to do away with the waiting week based upon requests from constituents and some other people. I do have with me Brad Leto of the Minnesota AFL-CIO, who can be heard on it. So I'll ask him to explain a little bit more about it, the history of it. But that said, I do understand that business or the chamber opposes this, and I would just say, well, it doesn't surprise me, but I think it's just a matter of justice. If you're unemployed and you're not getting paid for that time, that's what the insurance is for. It makes sense that you should be paid for that period of time.
Mr. Leto, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself to the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Brad Leto, from the Minnesota AFL-CIO, and since last session here, actually, this is Jennifer Schaubach, our legislative director. I've now changed positions over there. Would be here. She's at another other hearing at the same time. The AFL-CIO, Minnesota AFL-CIO, does support House Bill 1158, and we've had a long-standing position. I looked back to at least the mid or early 80s on our resolutions, and we have supported the elimination of the waiting week way back, and that's still the case. I know that probably the department said the waiting week, as long as you exhaust your benefits, as long as you go through 26 weeks of benefits, you get paid for it. But of course, if you had 24 weeks, you don't get paid for the waiting week. It's always been kind of a thorn, I guess, in our side, or we always get calls. I mean, every year we'll get calls from both actually union and non-union people that will just call us because they know that we're interested in that, saying, you know, why don't I get paid for the first week unless I use all my benefits up? And if you look at the average, I think the department can tell you, if you look at the average, how many people actually exhaust their 26 weeks, it is not, it's not everybody, I know that, and I'm not exactly sure, but the average is substantially less than 26, where around 20 weeks or so, probably. The department could tell you that. Also, I don't think it probably is an administrative burden at this time, which I know was always talked about in the past under old system of how benefits, the benefit year was calculated and that sort of thing, but that certainly would be a question for them as well. But I don't think that right now it's an administrative burden. So we have always supported it. We continue to support it, and I'm sure you will hear that it costs money to do this. But it is, if you think about it, where is the money coming from? It's from those workers that don't get paid for that week of unemployment, even though they're still unemployed. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifier? Representative Gunther.
Thank you. Mr. Leto, who pays it?
It would come out of the unemployment insurance. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther. It would come out of the unemployment insurance trust fund, which is paid for by business.
Representative Gunther.
You said it was paid for by employers? Is that
yes, correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none. I have, speaking to the bill, Ms. Jackie Engmark, the Minnesota Recruiting Staffing Association, Dwayne Hendrickson from Masterson Personnel, and Brad Connick from GTA Staffing. I hope I'm not doing undue damage to any of those names. If you all please come forward, I will let you organize yourselves, but please simply introduce yourselves to the tape and proceed. You're given about 7 minutes for the three of you to testify to the bill.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Jackie Engmark. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Recruiting and Staffing Association, also known as MNRSA. And we are here today. We respectfully oppose this bill. The Minnesota Recruiting and Staffing Association is a result of a recent merger with the Staffing Association of Minnesota and the Minnesota Personnel Association of Personnel Services. We are the largest staffing industry association in the state. We represent over 500 staffing companies in the metro area, as well as outstate, Rochester, Mankato, Owatonna, St. Cloud, up north, even as far as Tower, we have members. On a daily basis, our industry employs over 49,000 people and over 200,000 people on an annual basis. In addition, we provide over $1.1 billion in annual payroll. Most importantly, though, over 72,000 employees found permanent jobs as a result of working temporary. Our employees work in virtually every skill level, job category, administrative, light industrial, engineering, IT, etc. And this bill would negatively affect not only our industry, but our clients' businesses and all businesses. And it would have an unfair and disproportionate impact on employers with large numbers of temporary and part-time employees. At this time, I have two of our staffing industry professionals with me, and I'd like to, they're going to speak to the fact that it will impact their businesses. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Engler. Please introduce yourself to the table. I'll take the committee.
Chair and members, my name is Brad Connick. I'm with GKA Staffing. We're a local family-owned business. The company was founded by my father in 1974. We work with Minnesota companies and provide them with staffing solutions. I'll be very brief. As Jackie mentioned, we, as an industry, employ nearly 50,000 people on any given day. And part of the reason we're able to do that is we provide flexible employment options for these employees. It can be part-time, full-time, short-term, long-term, temp-to-perm, direct, etc. And due to providing that flexibility of employment, we do run into more turnaround in our employees than most companies would. And so this bill is going to affect our industry as much, if not more, than any other company out there because of the natural turnover that we have. And my concern, and the reason that this should be of concern, is that I understand that the employee's best interest is in mind, and that's what I think we need to keep in mind here, is that I think this is going to have a detrimental impact on the employee because as the additional tax burden is passed on to businesses and our industry as in particular, it's going to reduce the amount of resources that we have to do our job. And what our job is to find employees jobs in the state of Minnesota. I mean, that is what we do. We're not an individual company, and we're not dependent on our own individual growth. We're out there working with companies across the state and making sure that we can quickly and efficiently match them up with employees that are looking. And when you start placing a tax burden like this on us, it reduces our resources. And from our perspective, a small family-owned company, the tax burden that this potentially would put on us may cause me to reduce my staff. And not only am I now going to be adding individuals to the unemployment pool, but now I'm going to be eliminating positions that otherwise would have been helping hundreds, if not thousands of people, connect with jobs in the state of Minnesota. And that's why I oppose this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Connick.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dwayne Henderson, and I'm an employee of a company called Masterson Personnel. I'm not an owner. I don't have stock or equity in the company. I'm proud to celebrate today my 21st year of finding jobs for people in Minnesota. My company, based in St. Louis Park, Minnesota, has offices in Winona, Rochester, St. Cloud, Chaska, Pine City, Cambridge, Minneapolis, St. Paul. I'm not going to name all 21 locations throughout the state, but my company employed 17,850 people in 2007. And it's my hope that we'll grow that number in 2008. I believe, as I think everyone in this room believes, and I'm a voting Democrat, unlike many of my colleagues that I respect greatly. I believe that creating jobs in Minnesota can solve many of the challenges our state currently faces. In the past years, I've seen companies from both manufacturing and service sectors leave Minnesota to relocate to more business-friendly states. The early estimates that I'm getting from my accounting and IT department at Masterson Personnel tell me that the elimination of this 1-week waiting period would cost our company upwards of $250,000 a year. This would have a devastating impact on our ability to add jobs. I believe there's a reason that the majority of the states in America have that 1 week waiting period. Recently, the unemployment rate in Minnesota has gone above the national average. As a state, we are losing jobs. I believe this bill is written out of compassion for the 5.3% of Minnesotans who are eligible to receive benefits. But I do not believe that waiting 1 week to become eligible will create a severe hardship on those individuals. I do believe that keeping our companies in Minnesota and adding jobs is in the best interest of 100% of our constituents. I'm here to ask everyone in this room to do what's best for adding jobs to our state economy. Thank you for the opportunity to allow us to express our opinion.
Thanks, Mr. Henderson. Any questions from members for this panel of testifiers? Seeing none. I'm sorry, Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Henderson,
yes.
You pointed out it'd be a big hardship for your company. Could you tell me if we paid the first week, person was laid off for 4 weeks, they would call in at the end of the second week and say, I'm still laid off. They call in at the end of the third week and say, I'm still laid off. They would get 5 checks, potentially, in 4 weeks. Is there a requirement that person that got 5 checks has to repay the system?
Mr. Henderson.
No, not to my knowledge. No, there is no requirement for them to repay.
So a person in the state that has one of the best benefits in the nation, up to $500-some per week, there is no way to recoup an unearned week because of the first week benefit.
Representative Gunther, Mr. Nelson from Deed is on the list to testify, and he can also speak to these questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Diederich, from the chamber is wanting to come down. Mr. Nelson, why don't we let Mr. Diederich go first, and then batting cleanup will be Mr. Nelson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you this morning. It's nice to be back. For the record, my name is Dave Diederich with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I'll be brief given the time limitations to the committee, Mr. Chair. Briefly, the Minnesota Chamber does oppose this bill. Currently, Minnesota businesses pay approximately $1 billion a year in unemployment benefits taxes, and the removal of the one-week waiting period as suggested in this bill would increase employers' costs or unemployment insurance benefits costs by $40 million a year approximately. And these higher costs would affect employers through increased experience ratings. And so this bill has a definite adverse effect on Minnesota businesses. And most states actually do have a one-week waiting period. 36 states do have one-week waiting periods, so it's not like Minnesota is out of line with what's occurring in the rest of the country. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks and turn the podium over to Mr. Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Diederich. Mr. Nelson, welcome to the committee. If you'd please address the bill, but also perhaps address specifically Representative Gunther's concerns as well.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Gunther, if an individual was unemployed for 4 weeks, under the bill as proposed, they would collect unemployment benefits for 4 weeks. They would not get 5. They would collect for 4 weeks. And we currently, if you're unemployed for 4 weeks, would be paid unemployment benefits for 3. A couple of things I might comment on. A waiting week has been in place in one form or another since 1936. It is not a new concept. It has existed since the beginning of the program. I can give a rundown on history, but I'm not sure that's all that important. A couple of things I just want to make clear to people so they're just aware of it. 55 to 60% of all people who apply for unemployment benefits are going to return to their same employer. they are seasonally or temporarily laid off. One third of everyone who applies for unemployment benefits in a year applied the prior year. So they collect year after year. One third of everyone who applies for unemployment benefits. I just want members to be aware of those. Currently, one third, just less than that, I have the exact figure, I think it's 32.6% or something, who apply for unemployment benefits exhaust their benefit entitlement. Most people do not exhaust. So every individual who is found eligible for something, well, 60% of them would receive an additional week of unemployment benefits. That's why the cost is what Mr. Dieters indicated. About 100,000 people, a little over 100,000, would receive an additional unemployment benefit check under this bill. That's why it is a very large bill. The department has a concern that additional payouts and unemployment benefits will result in increased costs on employers, increased taxes on employers, and the department's position is that benefits in Minnesota are adequate. I won't use terms very generous, but it is adequate. We pay substantially higher benefits than most states which do not have that waiting week. Wisconsin does not have a waiting week. Their maximum entitlement is $359. Minnesota's currently is $538, and it automatically adjusts each year. Wisconsin does not. So members should just keep some of those things in mind when addressing this bill. If there are any questions, I can probably answer them.
Thanks, Mr. Nelson. Any questions for Mr. Nelson? Representative Calvi.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nelson, I do have a question because it's my understanding that the companies that lay people off, then their insurance premiums go up in the following year to pay that back, so to speak, rather than every business in the state. Is that correct?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, but what happens is over a four-year, there's a four-year experience rating period. If benefits are paid out, the employer's taxes, if you will go up enough to recoup 125% of that. The employers actually pay more than the benefit cost. And some of the reason is because some employers go out of business and could never recover it, so there has to be some extra. But yes, that's how it works.
Representative Scalzi.
Just as a follow-up, then not every business would be impacted in the same way as the businesses who do this year after year after year. They are the ones that are the most impacted rather than another business who doesn't lay off people all the time.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, not exactly, because many employers are at the maximum rate. Minnesota has a cap. So many, many employers don't, in effect, reimburse the fund the full cost, because they're at that maximum. The fund actually loses $100 million a year on those maximum rate employers. So then that cost is spread across all employers. Over 10,000 businesses go out of business every year, and that cost is spread across all employers. So it will, not all of this additional benefits paid out will be charged back to an individual employer. Many of them will not be, and then spread across all employers, raising all employers' rates.
Ms. Calvi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just as a follow-up then, without a fiscal note, do you have any idea what kind of money we're talking about that it would cost? I mean, it would only cost the state money if the state were laying off employees themselves. This fund is reimbursed by the businesses.
No.
Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, if any, it works a little different for the state of Minnesota as an employer and political subdivisions as an employer as opposed to for-profit. It's a rather detailed explanation, and I'm sure we'll get into it at this point. Mr. Peters is correct. Had this bill been in place in 2006, it would have cost just under $35 million, and of course it benefits amount of unemployment benefits being paid out or have increased since 2006. Those are the last years we can get full figures for. So it would cost that additional amount to businesses. How much it would cost the state of Minnesota, which has a number of employees on seasonal and permanent separations, I guess I don't have an estimation of what it would cost the state of Minnesota is an employer. That's from the general fund. Okay. Representative Peters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm going to follow kind of the same line of questions. Should this not have a fiscal note? Because if this bill gets to the floor before the supplemental budget end of February, it could have a significant impact on that. Am I missing something?
Mr. Elton, if I may, Representative Peterson, can you clarify, I may be asking the same thing in a different way. Is there a general fund impact, potential general fund impact of this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, unemployment benefits are paid from the Minnesota Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. It's a separate trust fund, which is actually on deposit in Washington. That's a whole nother story. So it is a separate trust fund. It isn't general fund money. However, when the state of Minnesota is an employer and lays someone off, and the state of Minnesota has a lot of seasonal employees with the Department of Transportation, Department of Natural Resources, and these types of things, the state of Minnesota does have a healthy unemployment insurance bill, and the state does not pay taxes to support the fund like all private businesses do. What the state does, if benefits are paid to a former state worker, the state gets a bill quarterly and the state pays the bill. So it would have some impact on the state of Minnesota as an employer, and thus a general fund impact. I could probably have some numbers run on that as to what it would actually cost the general fund. But that would be because the state is the employer and the state of Minnesota laid people off. The state has a lot of seasonal employees.
Representative Peters.
I'm not sure what I'm asking. I'll pass for now.
Other questions or concerns? Representative Peters.
So are we saying that this does not require any fiscal note? It does not.
No. I am unclear. And concerned about the
would it
so the issue
if
you
we're unclear, wouldn't it not be appropriate to bring this past with a fiscal note so we talking apples to apples? I'm hearing costs of $35 and $39 million. Numbers are being thrown around, and I don't know which pocket they're coming out of.
Representative Peterson, Mr. Nelson, to clarify, my understanding is the $35 million number from 2006 was cost to the trust fund, not cost to the state of Minnesota as an employer. You do not currently have a projection on the cost to the state as an employer. Is that correct, sir?
The chairman, members of the committee, that's correct.
Okay. One issue that was raised earlier, Mr. Nelson, I'd like clarification on for the committee's understanding. If someone is paid under the current law, or under Representative Lesh, where Representative Lesh's bill to go into effect, if someone is paid for a week for which they are employed, do they have an obligation to repay the trust fund that week's benefit?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes. They must repay it, and there are a number of mechanisms to recoup it if they do not voluntarily repay it.
Any other questions or concerns on the bill? Seeing none, and given the lack of clarity on the fiscal impact, I think at this point I'll exercise my prerogative as chair to hold this bill over for possible future consideration after further consultation with Representative Lesh. Representative Lesh, thank you very much. With that, members, in your packet is the are the minutes from the March 19th, 2007 meeting of this committee. Is there anyone who would like to move these minutes? Representative Hornstein moves the March 19th minutes. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. With that, ladies and gentlemen, we stand adjourned. I'll see you back next Friday. Thank you.